מה? Thank you, Mo. Thank you all for, first of all, hosting the Kola once again this summer, this week, and for joining us this evening as well. The evil eye is a topic, a concept that has both fascinated and, I would say, intimidated, depending on your perspective, people for not just centuries, but for thousands of years. And this is not just something which we find in Jewish culture, but it's something which is obvious and apparent in many cultures in antiquity. And not just the Jews, but the ancient Romans, Greeks, Babylonians, Assyrians, everyone felt afraid of, dealt with the evil eye. In fact, the evil eye actually made the news just a little over a week ago. Fox News reported that an Israeli lifeguard found a 2,500-year-old sea relic swimming off the coast of Israel in the Mediterranean. This Israeli lifeguard, David Shalom, discovered a white disc that is flat on one side, convex on the other, 8 inches in diameter. The center of the disc is perforated, and the remains of two circles are painted around the center of it to represent the pupil of an eye. And this disc was apparently mounted on the front of a ship 2,500 years ago. It was the type that was mounted both on military ships and on merchant ships, and it was intended to ward off the evil eye. So this was common not just hundreds of years ago, but thousands of years ago. And the question that I'd like to examine tonight is, what does the Jewish tradition have to say about the evil eye? And to examine that idea, we will first look at sources in which it is brought up, in which it is mentioned in the Chumash, in the Gemara, even in practical halacha, interestingly enough. And then we'll attempt to suggest numerous explanations as to how we understand such a notion. Or do we not understand such a notion? Do we reject it as superstitious entirely, and that's the end of the day? So to begin with, if you really look through the Tanakh, you don't find explicit references to the evil eye. There is one pasuk that is quoted, and I am referring now, quoted by Yehuda David Eisenstein in his encyclopedia, Otzar Yisrael. He quotes a pasuk in Shmuel Aleph, which mentions that Shaul was Oyein es David. Oyein, from the word ayin. And there the word Oyein es David means he would eye him with contempt, with jealousy, with hatred. So that's perhaps the closest we get in the Tanakh to this idea of eyeing somebody with an evil eye. But there it's used to mean eye him with a glare of contempt, of jealousy. Where we find the evil eye mentioned more often is not in the Tanakh itself in a literal, explicit sense, but in the interpretations of Chazal in explaining Psukim in Tanakh. And on the source sheet here, I mentioned a couple, and we'll mention a few others as well. But if you look at source number one, a pasuk in Parshas Ki Tisa, the pasuk says that God tells Moshe, Ki Sisa es Rosh Bnei Yisrael of Kudehem, when you count the Jewish people, so you're not supposed to count them by head, but rather, what do you do? Vinosnu ish kofar nafsho la'Hashem b'fkorosam. They should each give an atonement, a payment, a half a shekel per person, and then they won't suffer the plague when you count them. What was the purpose of this giving of the half a shekel coin when they were supposed to be counted? So Rashi here in source number two, although again it's not explicit in the pasuk simply says, when you count them, make sure they give you a half a shekel so they won't suffer the plague of death. Rashi adds to that and says, what plague are we talking about here? Why would they suffer? And Rashi says in source number two, Shehaminyan sholet bo ayin hara. Because, Rashi explains, when one counts, you make that or those people or items being counted vulnerable or susceptible to the ayin hara, to the evil eye, and its dangerous effects, hence the plague concern. And Rashi says, that's why there was a danger of plague. So rather than count the people directly, Rashi tells us they had to each pay a half a shekel, and you counted the money, you didn't count the people. So although the pasuk itself just simply says, watch out for the danger of the plague when counting the Jewish nation, and therefore they should pay half a shekel each, Rashi is one who elaborates on that and says, the concern here is danger from the evil eye. Another example, a little more recent in our Kriyas HaTorah cycle, is found in the psukim that discuss the story of Bilam trying to curse the Jewish nation. And here in source number three, again, the pasuk is not explicit. The pasuk simply says, Vayisa Bil'am es einav. Bilam raises his eyes. He sees the Jews, Vayaris Yisrael Shochem Lishvatav. He sees the Jewish encampments, Vatiyah La'Ruach Elokim, and the godly spirit dwells upon him. So again, the pasuk itself says simply, he raised his eyes. Could be understood ominously, could be understood innocently. Rashi is the one here in source number four who says, what do you mean he raised his eyes? That's a seemingly superfluous phrase in the Chumash. And Rashi says, Bikesh lahachnis bahem ayin ra'a. He raised his eyes in the ominous sense. He wanted to glare at them and attack them with the evil eye. So once again, a second example where Rashi, interpreting a pasuk in the Chumash, interjects this evil eye notion to a story that perhaps would not otherwise be interpreted as such. And I'll briefly outside mention two other examples in the Chumash where, again, Rashi throws in this idea of the evil eye. One is the story of Yaakov's 10 sons going down to Egypt in search of their brother Yosef, who had been sold years earlier. And the pasuk says that the sons of Yaakov entered into Egypt b'soch haboim, mingled amongst the numerous tourists or immigrants that are crossing over the border into Egypt. Okay, seemingly innocent pasuk. And yet again, there also, Rashi on that pasuk says, what do you mean they were intermingled b'soch haboim? They were intermingled, interspersed between the many tourists that were going into Egypt. And Rashi says that Yaakov intentionally instructed them to do just that. Why? Yaakov told them, says Rashi, if you're going to go down together, all 10 of you, mighty, handsome-looking warriors, you're going to walk in one border crossing, everyone's going to look at you, look at those Israelites, and that's going to make you susceptible to the evil eye, says Rashi. So Yaakov, Rashi tells us, deliberately told his sons, you go here, you go there, you go there, split up, 10 different border crossings, don't attract attention, and that way you'll be shielded from the evil eye. Another example where the Torah doesn't say it explicitly, yet Rashi interjects it. And one last example where Rashi throws this into the Chumash, again, not on the sheet, but just briefly outside, the story of the Luchos, the tablets that were smashed by Moshe Rabbeinu upon seeing the golden calf that was worshipped by the Jews. So Rashi says, why is it that the first set of tablets didn't make it? They didn't last too long. And the second set of tablets lasted much, much longer. They weren't smashed. So Rashi says, because the first set of tablets were given amidst great fanfare and celebration and thunder and shofar and light effects, sound effects, everybody was watching, it was a big show. So Rashi says, vulnerable to the evil eye, they didn't last too long. Second set of luchos, says Rashi, which were given a little more b'tzniut, Rashi says, a little more modestly, they lasted longer. Okay, so those are just briefly some examples in Chumash where Rashi, interpreting the stories in Chumash, throws in this idea of the evil eye and its harmful consequences. And again, somewhat difficult to understand, how does this operate, what does this mean? We'll try to get to that shortly. Where we find even more detailed mention of the evil eye and its harmful ramifications is in stories in the Gemara. And in the Gemara, there is actually a number of instances where the evil eye is used as an attack weapon. So the Gemara tells us, for example, about Rav Sheshes, who was being heckled by a non-believer, a min, the Gemara calls him. And eventually Rav Sheshes apparently felt that this individual was going too far. So the Gemara says, Nasan bo'enav, he put his eye on him, he glared at him, and Nasa gal shalatzamos, the offending individual became a pile of bones on the spot. That's pretty cool if you could pull that off. Imagine that, people walking around and just shooting evil eye glances at people. It's pretty disastrous. Pretty shocking too. Just looked at him and it became a pile of bones on the spot. Very fascinating story. It's even more fascinating because Rav Sheshet is known to be blind, but it's an additional component to that story, so the Gemara doesn't really mention. In other instances, the Gemara says, not as drastically, the Gemara says, if somebody finds a lost object, and the Gemara is talking about, let's say, a set of clothing, you find a lost jacket or something like that, and you want to air it out. So the Gemara says, don't air it out in public when you have guests in your house, because one of the concerns is, the Gemara says, Ein Abisha, the evil eye, the guests are going to look, ooh, look at that fancy Italian suit. Wow, that's really nice. And everyone's going to look at it, talk about it, and it might suffer the consequences, quote unquote. So out of your concern for returning the lost suit in its best condition, don't air it out in front of your guests. It's another example the Gemara quotes. And what's most amazing is that this notion of the evil eye has found its way not just into the stories of the Talmud, into Rashi's commentary to the Chumash, but even to the Halacha Lamaisa, to the Shulchan Aruch's code of law that we follow today. And we might not be aware that we're doing certain things or not doing certain things for these reasons, but it's there. So, for example, a number of halachos, three to be exact, that I'll mention that we follow today as a result of this concern of the evil eye. The Shulchan Aruch says that it is forbidden for one to stand next to a friend's field or garden when it is in full bloom, when all the crops have grown in, or when it's, you know, at its height of growth. This is Shulchan Aruch in Choshen Mishpat and Simen Shin Ayin Ches. You're not allowed to stand next to your friend's field, you know, when the wheat is at its highest height. Why? So in the Gemara, the reason given for this halacha is because you might inflict damage upon your friend's property due to the evil eye. And this finds its way into the Shulchan Aruch. Again, very perplexing how to understand what the mechanics of that are. I didn't realize that I was so, you know, capable until I read that halacha. So how do we understand that? It's a great question. We'll get to that. Perhaps a little more common, another halacha that's found in the Ramah in Evan Ha'ezer and Simen Samach Beis. The Ramah says, what happens when you're making two weddings at the same time? Now, this was very common when thousands of Russian immigrants came from Soviet Russia, and many of them had not had the opportunity when they were living under the communist regime to get married halachically. They might have had a civil marriage, but not a proper religious marriage ceremony. And a number of them, when they came over to this country, or to the U.S., or to Israel, they perhaps were, you know, already years married civilly, but they never had that opportunity to have a religious marriage, and they were very often married all as one, together by, you know, a rabbi here, a rabbi there. And yet the Ramah says that when performing such a marriage ceremony, you can't just have two grooms under the chuppah and say one set of Shavuot brachos for both. Ayin hara. So the Ramah says, give them each their separate chuppah ceremony, a separate set of seven Shavuot brachos for each one, to avoid the evil eye. And finally, one last halacha, perhaps the most common, although again we might not realize it, is a halacha that presumably is found in the secret Gabbai's handbook. And that is the following. Now, we take it for granted that every Shabbos morning, the Gabbai calls up the people to the Torah to read the Torah. He knows what he's doing. It's all running smoothly. We just sit back and let it happen. And yet, the Shulchan Aruch tells us that a Gabbai who's making the calls has to be very careful not to give two consecutive aliyot to two brothers, or to a father and son, or a son and a father. You cannot call up to the Torah consecutively two brothers, or a father and a son, or a son and a father. Why not? So the Shulchan Aruch himself says, he concedes, it's not really usur, it's not prohibited by law, but because of concern of the evil eye, people looking, oh, look at that family, oh, look at that family, start looking, start talking, we don't do it. We don't do it. And this finds its way into Shulchan Aruch. And again, the question is, how do we make sense of this? Was this just superstition that we're still, you know, living by because it made its way into the Shulchan Aruch? Or is there more to it that perhaps I can be understanding of even from today's modern perspective? So to begin, let's look at some sources on the page. And we'll start with a Mishnah in Pirkei Avos. And this Mishnah in Pirkei Avos is one of those sources in the Mishnah that makes mention of the evil eye. Although it's not entirely clear that the Mishnah is using it in the colloquial sense that we use it in today. The Mishnah source number 5 on the page says the following. The Mishnah says, Amar lahem, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai said to his 5 greatest students, Tzu'u ru'u, I want you to go out and tell me. Go out and see. Ezohi derech ra'ah sheyisrachek mimenu ha'adam. What is the most evil of ways in life that I should be very cautious to avoid? So the Gemara says, Rabbi Eliezer responds, Ayin ra'ah. Make sure you avoid the evil eye, the ayin ra'ah. And Rabbi Yeshua, his colleague, disagreed and said, no, chaver ra, a bad friend is even more dangerous. So here we find Rabbi Eliezer using that loaded term, ayin ra'ah, the evil eye, as the most dangerous thing to avoid in life. What does he mean by it, though? Comes the Rambam, and the Rambam, as many will tell you, was amongst the great Rishonim, perhaps one of the most rational thinkers in terms of his tendencies to dismiss that which might be viewed as superstitious. And the Rambam doesn't fail us here either. He takes a very rational approach to interpreting this loaded term, ayin ra'ah. He doesn't say it means this hocus pocus magic, look at you, boom, you're dead. What does it mean? The Rambam says in source number 6 the following. He says, ayin tova, a good eye, means ha-histapkus ba-meshe yesh la-adam, being satisfied and content with what you have. It means your perception of what you own in life. That, says the Rambam, is mima'alos hamidos. That's an ideal character trait. What is ayin ra'ah that you must avoid? That's not, again, that glare of death, but rather, says the Rambam, it's the opposite of the ayin tova. And all it means, very simply, says the Rambam, is someone who looks at what he has and is never satisfied. He's always trying to make more money, get more. His ayin ra does not mean he looks at you with an evil eye, but it means he looks at life and looks at his own status in life with discontent. He's never happy. He never has enough. That's an ayin ra, says the Rambam. It doesn't mean magical stuff. It means your perception is pessimistic in nature. You look at what you own and you're not happy. You're always looking for more. That's what the Mishnah means by ayin ra. Stay away from a bad eye. Now, if the shir ended there, so we wouldn't have anything to talk about. But the truth is, if we look at the next Mishnah and the comments of other Rishonim on the Mishnah, it starts to get a little exciting or a little more troubling, however you define it. Because in the very next Mishnah, or a few Mishnahs later, Rabbi Yoshua, who just told us that the worst thing in life is a bad friend, tells us something else. And source number 7, Rabbi Yoshua says, Ayin hara, an evil eye, the yetzer hara, and the evil inclination, Visinas habrios, and hatred of people, motzi'in es ha'adam in ha'olam. Are those three things, are those things that are will destroy a person in this world? Those three things, the evil eye, the evil inclination, and hatred of people will destroy a person and ruin him. And the Rambam, true to form, on this Mishnah says, oh, well, ayin hara, the evil eye means that you're not happy with what you have. Somebody who's not happy with what he has will never have a happy life. He'll just destroy himself in the process. The problem, though, is that in this Mishnah, Rabbi Yoshua, if you look carefully at source number 7, Rabbi Yoshua is the one who's saying that ayin hara, the evil eye, will destroy a person. And yet, in the previous source, number 5, what did Rabbi Yoshua say is the worst thing in life? A chavera, a bad friend. So, he's not referring to the ayin ra'ah that we mentioned earlier. He's saying something different now. So what is he referring to? And this is where other Rishonim, contemporaries or later contemporaries of the Rambam, give us a very vastly different interpretation of the evil eye. And here's what they say. In source number 8, Rabbeinu Yonah says the following. He says, evil eye does not just mean one who's not happy with what he has. Hold on to your seats. It says the following. He says, Perish this means, Mi she'eno sameach b'chelko, someone who's not content with what he has, so far pretty rational, va'oyein es chaveiro ha'ashir mimenu, and he's always looking at his friend who's wealthier than he is. Masai ye'asher osha gadol kamo, when will I become as wealthy as he is? V'hu goyim ra la'atzmo u'lechaveiro, and that will cause harm to himself and to his friend. Kasher amru chachme hateva, as the scientists, the philosophers have explained. What do they explain? Now this is interesting because Rabbeinu Yonah, and we'll see other Rishonim as well, when they present their explanation and understanding of the evil eye, as strange as it might sound to the modern day reader, it was really based on the scholarship of that time, as they quote themselves. And what is it? They say the following. They say, avir ole min hamachshava hahu. There is this air, this emission, that is created by one's jealous thoughts. V'soreifes hadvarim she'oyein bahem be'enav hara. And it will attack, incinerate, burn those objects that you are jealously eyeing. Gam bekerbo yisareif. Even within the person, those jealous thoughts will create this bad air, this bad emission that will wreak havoc inside one's body. Because you're so desperate to get what you can't get. That jealous thought, it will harm the person physically. And that's what Ayin Hara is, says Rabbeinu Yonah. So in a word, he says, he's quoting the Chachmei HaTeva, he's quoting the secular scientists of the time, or philosophers of that time, that Ayin Ra'ah, the evil eye, he says, is when you're jealous of someone else and you're looking at what he has that you don't have it, and you want it badly and you can't get it, that thought, that jealous thought, creates some sort of emission, some bad air that comes out of the person and attacks the object that you're eyeing. Very interesting. The Abarbanel, in his comments to this mission as well, follows this train of thought. He even tells you where it comes from. He quotes the philosopher Abu Hamid. I don't know who Abu Hamid is. It sounds like it could be anybody in the Muslim world at that time. But he quotes the philosopher Abu Hamid, who takes this approach in explaining the evil eye. And notice, this was something that all cultures at that time, you know, were wary of, even the Muslims, etc. And he also says, think about it, he writes. He says, when a person gets angry, really angry, sometimes he'll turn red in the face. You see that the thoughts, the emotions, create turmoil in the person, physically. So he suggests, perhaps then as well, the jealousy that is burning within a person when he sees something that someone else has and he doesn't have, also creates some sort of physical change, perhaps unseen, that will wreak havoc not just on the person himself, but on the objects that you're looking at. And that is the evil eye. Again, to the modern reader, this probably sounds very suspicious. Unseen emissions that are attacking what I don't like in somebody else's home. And Rabbi Nayon and the Barbanel are not making it up. They're quoting the scholars of their time. And yet what's interesting is that even more recent writers have attempted to explain or accept or justify this kind of thinking. Rabbi Baruch Epstein, who lived about 100 years ago, writes in his comments on the Torah, on Parshas Balak, he says, this has been proved in an experiment performed in St. Petersburg in 1881. And he quotes a Russian newspaper, I think it's pronounced Ilya Strirani Mir, I don't know, I don't read Russian, I don't know Russian. And this same newspaper is actually quoted by Yehuda David Eisenstein in his Otzar Yisrael Encyclopedia. I'm not sure if he's quoting Rabbi Baruch Epstein or he found it independently, but this Russian newspaper in 1881 apparently described a St. Petersburg experiment carried out by the Academy of Sciences in St. Petersburg. There was a prisoner of the Tsar who was sentenced to die, and the Academy of the Sciences requested permission from the Tsar to use the prisoner in a medical experiment. They locked him up in a cell for 3 days and starved him. They then took a beautiful, luscious-looking, delicious, fresh loaf of bread and cruelly placed it right outside his cell, just out of reach. And you can imagine this poor man who was starving for 3 days is just eyeing that bread and he's dying for it. And he can't reach it. And apparently this newspaper quotes that when the researchers then took that loaf of bread after some time, after this prisoner had been eyeing it for the longest time, they tested it and found poisonous substances in it. Again, I can't confirm that. I wasn't there. I didn't read it in the original. Just quoting you what these secondary sources quote. And apparently this Russian newspaper in 1881 quotes these researchers in St. Petersburg as saying, aha, we see that the eye has this ability. Same way the eyes can hypnotize. There's this unseen force in the eye that can create physical effects, physical ramifications in something that it's looking at. I leave that to you. If you find the newspaper, please let me know. I haven't read in the original, but it sounds interesting. When I mentioned this in a shir that I gave in my shul in New York. So one of the women in my congregation said, "Oh, this sounds very similar to Dr. Masaru Emoto." And my response was exactly that. Who in the world is Dr. Masaru Emoto? Apparently, and I realized, she emailed me afterwards, YouTube interviews with this individual, and you can find his book online if you're so inclined. Apparently, he is a professor in Japan who conducted and allegedly proved similar kinds of interesting phenomena where there is an unseen force that impacts the world around it. And again, I didn't read the book, and I hadn't heard of this fellow until a few weeks ago, but again, I throw it out to you if you're interested to pursue it. Dr. Masaru Emoto. Apparently, he took bottles of water and wrapped little letters or notes around the bottles of water. And one letter is like a love letter, said very nice things to the water. One letter was a very nasty letter, said very nasty things to the water. And then I guess he froze it and he analyzed the water, and the crystals in the bottles of water looked different. The one that had the nice lovely letter written to it had beautifully formed crystals. And the one that had the nasty letter written to it had all these misshapen, out of whack crystals. And the idea, you see pictures of them online. Again, what to make of that? I have no clue. But it's just a point of interest. If you think there's anything to do with our topic at hand, feel free to pursue it, and please let me know. If not, we'll proceed. And the question that becomes, of course, if we are not inclined to accept this medieval interpretation of the evil eye, how then do we understand it, or do we not understand it? Now, the truth is, the Rambam, once again, the rationalist amongst the Rishonim, appears to reject this superstitious belief in the evil eye. And the reason why I say that is because the halacha I mentioned to you earlier about not standing alongside a friend's field or garden when the crops are in full bloom, the Rambam, when he quotes the halacha, does not make any mention of not allowed to look. Other Rishonim say you got to build a 6-foot wall between your field and your friend's field, so you shouldn't be eyeing his crops. Rambam says, no, build a 10 tefach, a little 40-inch barrier, so you know whose field is whose. He doesn't mind if you're looking at the guy's field. And he was asked about this. Well, what happened to that, no looking rule? And the Rambam responds by saying, oh, when the Gemara says that you're not allowed to stand and look at your friend's crops, that's not a real halacha that is accepted, by the conclusion of the Gemara. That's a midas chasidus. That's an extra measure of piety. We don't want you to be jealous, so it's better not to eye your friend's crops jealously. But it doesn't find its way into the actual halacha of not being allowed to look at your friend's field. So the Rambam, true to form, would appear to reject this entire notion of the fear of the damage that could be inflicted by the evil eye, and he therefore omits this halacha from his code of law. However, as I said earlier, the Shulchan Aruch, though, does accept it as halacha. So how do we understand this? So the Chazon Ish, source number 9, one of the greatest Gedolei Torah of the last generation, essentially really throws up his hands and says, I can't explain it. But what he says is, and he's referring to the Gemara that I mentioned to you earlier, or one of the Gemaras of the Amoraim, the Talmudic rabbis who glared at somebody and he dropped dead on the spot. He says, how does that work? The evil eye causes death, brings death to somebody. So he says very simply, Misodos Habriya, it's one of the secrets of creation. In other words, there are so many things that we haven't yet figured out and maybe never will figure out about how this world operates, and things that we will figure out in the future. This, he says, is one of those secrets of creation that we just don't know yet how it operates. He says, Ki ha'adam b'machshavta hu meinia gormim nistorim ba'olam ha'ma'aseh. A person with his thoughts can effect or cause these hidden forces in the world to operate. U'machshavta ha'kala, and his simple thoughts can cause destruction of physical objects. So the Chazon Ish says, listen, he says, I can't explain it to you. It's one of those secrets of creation that we have not yet mastered or figured out. And that's all there is to it. He doesn't know. He can't tell you rationally how it operates. And nevertheless, he doesn't reject it out of hand. He says, listen, we find so many sources that in the Gemara that it actually worked. So I can't explain it, he says. It's one of the secrets of creation. Later, figure of Dessler Zatzal, a little later than the Chazon Ish, but also from the last generation, And his Sefer Michtav Melio offers us what might be perhaps the most rational explanation, one that I guess would sit best with people's modern sensibilities. And he says the following. He writes very interestingly as follows. He says, what is the evil eye? You know, we're used to hearing about the evil eye when somebody displays his newfound wealth, or someone displays his fancy new sports car, or whatever it is that he just was able to all of a sudden acquire that his friends don't have. And they're all eyeing him jealously. So that's when people talk about, it's vulnerable to the evil eye. So how does that work, says Rav Dessler? Why should it be that when I display something or flaunt something that others don't have and others are jealous of, that makes it vulnerable to the evil eye? So he suggests something which is very creative because he's the first to suggest it, and yet it's very interesting. He says, there's no question that when I burn with envy and jealousy at something that you have that I don't have, so who's the guilty party here? Me. Why am I jealous? I should be better than that. And yet, says Rav Dessler, if I, on the other hand, flaunt needlessly that which I have, which others don't, and I elicit and invite the jealousy and envy of others, so I too am held somewhat accountable. Of course, the one who's jealous and burning with rage and envy is the one who's more guilty here. But the person who elicits that envy, who unnecessarily invites the jealousy by flaunting what he has, what others don't, so why are you doing that? Why are you making your neighbors, your friends miserable for no reason? So Rav Dessler says, what the evil eye means, not some magic hocus pocus that someone else looks at you with that glare and boom, your car goes up in smoke. What it means, he says, is that if you are needlessly flaunting something which you have and unnecessarily inviting the envy and jealousy of your friends and neighbors and making them miserable, so I'm also held accountable for making others miserable. And at times, he says, perhaps divine justice will determine that I therefore am no longer worthy of having that particular item. Because if I needlessly make others jealous and envious of me, then God might decide, you know what, I'm not deserving of it, and he'll take it from me. That is how Rabbi Dessler explains the evil eye phenomenon in tradition. Now, how would this explain the rabbi who glared at somebody and the guy dropped dead? So perhaps Rabbi Dessler would say that this individual who was antagonizing Rav Sheshes unnecessarily, Rav Sheshes was someone who carried so much weight up in heaven that when he was upset by someone, so God acted on that offense, so to speak, in the most drastic of ways. Now, this might also be an interesting explanation to a somewhat perplexing Gemara. The Gemara says in Maseches Brachos that descendants of Yosef are immune to the evil eye. Why? Because Yaakov Avinu compared Yosef and his children, v'yidgu larov b'karev ha'aretz. They should be like fish, dagim. And the Gemara says, just like dagim, ein ha'ayin sholetes behem, they're not vulnerable to the evil eye, so too the descendants of Yosef, who were given the blessing by Yaakov to be compared to the evil eye, are not susceptible to the evil eye. Why are fish not susceptible to the evil eye? Why are those lucky creatures immune and no one else is? So, if you took the medieval approach that the evil eye is this unseen force or air that emanates from my glare and my jealous thoughts and attacks something else, so the fish are underwater and my unseen force can't penetrate water. Okay, that's how I would explain it if I was taking the medieval approach. Rav Dessler, though, explains interestingly as follows. He says, fish represent those creatures that live in a different existence. They're not jealous of us up here. And they don't make us jealous of them down there. They're in the water, we're on earth. It's two different societies, so to speak. They live their own life, and they don't look at us and don't elicit our jealousy. So fish are completely removed, he says, or represent those individuals or creatures that are completely removed from inviting others' jealousy, and therefore they are representative of those that are immune to the evil eye. So too, says Rav Dessler, those who don't elicit jealousy of others unnecessarily, they don't flaunt something unnecessarily, will be immune to the evil eye. Now, with this in mind, we come to the last source on the page where the Gemara gives us one of the secrets to protection from the evil eye. How do I protect myself from the evil eye? Well, there's many ways you can do it. Many ancient cultures tied red strings on their fingers, which The Tosefta Masechta Shabbos says it's Darkei HaEmori, and you can't do that. Others, Yehuda Eisenstein quotes, somehow adopted this custom of spitting three times, which today made its way into the poo-poo-poo you hear sometimes. How that works is way beyond me. Some simply say, B'li Ayin Hara, or K'n Ayin Hara, or whatever permutation it has evolved into, K'n Ayin Hara, K'n Ayin Hara, K'n Ayin Hara, however you pronounce it nowadays. That actually is found in the Munkacha Rebbe's writings. That's something which he suggests doing. But what does the Gemara tell us one should do to avoid the evil eye? So the Gemara says in source number 10, Gemara Mesechas Tainis, the Amar Rebbe Yitzchak, Rabbi Yitzchak says, "Ein habracha mitzuya ela bedavar hasamoy min ha'ayin." Blessing will only find its way into those items that are into those things that are hidden or concealed from the eye. Which is exactly what we were just saying from Rev Dessler. The more something is concealed, the less likely it is to elicit someone else's envy or jealousy. The more I don't brag about what I have, the less likely someone else will be jealous of it. And that, says the Gemara, is the best way to ensure bracha in what one owns in one's life. To keep it hidden. Not to brag about it, not to publicize it unnecessarily. So, for example, just this past year, when an Orthodox Jew in Staten Island, New York, won $18 million in New York Lotto. And, first of all, he made every other Orthodox Jew angry because now their odds of winning are all the much worse. But the first thing he did was, he quickly sent a text message to all his friends, my new phone number is, without saying why. And when he came for the photo shoot, you know, on the front page of the Staten Island Advance newspaper, he had his hat pulled down really low, so you really couldn't recognize him if you didn't know who he was, and tried to give a very, 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 very low profile. Why? Because Eina Bracha Mitzuya, Ela Bedavra, Sama Min Ayin. I don't know if he was thinking of this Gemara per se, but he was clearly wary of not eliciting other people's calls or solicitation visits for money, whichever one was really foremost in his mind, I don't know. But this then would be the perhaps, you know, one of the first avenues of approach to take to keep things, their blessings, hidden when not necessary to flaunt them. So just to sum up what we've discussed this evening, we found references, numerous references to the evil eye in the commentaries on the Chumash, in the Gemara. We found a machlokus amongst the Rishonim, different opinions, how to understand reference to the evil eye in the Mishnah. Does it mean simply someone who's not happy with what he owns? Or does it refer to some mysterious force or that I can effect with my glare at something or someone? And the two more contemporary approaches to understanding the evil eye, that of the Chazon Ish, that it's one of the secret forces in creation that operates the way God wants it to, or that of Rav Dessler, that it means that one should be wary of not evoking unnecessarily jealousy or envy of others by flaunting unnecessarily that which I have, which those don't. And anyone has any questions, I'd be happy to take them. Thank you very, very much.
Yes.